headlines, an airbase hosting American troops comes under attack in Iraq's Anbar province hours after drones targeted U.S. base at Erbil Airport. Iran calls on the Afghan people and political leaders to take tough decisions for their future as Tehran hosts talks between a Taliban delegation and prominent Afghan figures. And Kazakhstan's capital is hosting the 16th round of peace talks on the Syria crisis. Delegations from Turkey, Iran, and Russia are participating in the negotiations. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. This is the second such attack this week on the base in Iraq's western Anbar province. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said three people were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Ain al-Assad was also hit by three rockets on Monday. The latest attack came less than a day after drones hit another U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan region. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. Anti-American sentiments run high in the Arab country since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January last year. A U.S. military base located near Syria's Al-Omar oil field in Deir al-Zawr province has reportedly come under attack. Reports say several mortar shells hit the base just 3 days after a barrage of rockets targeted the same facility in eastern Syria. The attacks follow amid growing anger over last week's U.S. airstrikes against resistance groups near the Iraqi-Syria border. Hundreds of American troops are stationed in northeastern Syria without the permission of Damascus. The Syrian government describes the U.S. military as illegitimate. Damascus has also lambasted the U.S. military after taking over the country's largest oil field. Iran has unveiled and put into service a range of domestically built military equipment. The arms have been delivered to the Iranian ground force during a ceremony attended by senior military officials. Yusuf Jalali was there and filed this report.
Dozens of drones, missiles, tanks, and armored vehicles joined the arsenal of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on Wednesday. Commander-in-Chief of the IRGC, Major General Hossein Salami, along with other senior military officials, paid a visit to the IRGC ground force to attend the ceremony. General Salami hailed the Iranian armed forces for defying U.S. arms bans. As he said, all of the new arms were developed indigenously.
I should thank the Defense Ministry and the armed forces for lending their support to the ground force. The ground force is the backbone of the military power and needs to be bolstered as much as possible. Today, you witnessed the scale of our ground force capability.
Among the latest equipment delivered to the IRGC ground force were a variety of homegrown UAVs with reconnaissance, surveillance, and combat applications. A range of precision-guided missiles and missile launchers were also added to the IRGC's arsenal as part of efforts to bolster the country's defense capability. The IRGC says the new equipment are produced based on plans to smarten up the country's defense sector.
Today we are making great strides in modernizing and smartening our military sector. We are now producing optical and electronic intelligence gathering systems, long-range drones, strong firepower, self-propelled artillery, and intelligent and updated tanks. All of the hardware is developed by our experts in Iran.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of sanctions led by the United States, coupled with 8 years of Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. The arms bans prompted the Islamic Republic to stand on its own feet and build up its arms arsenal using its own know-how to defend its sovereignty. Today, the Iranian armed forces claim the country produces more than 80% of its needed weapons indigenously.
Military officials here say from the nuts and bolts to the most sophisticated parts of these equipment are produced domestically. They say U.S. arms embargoes have not been a hurdle, but a tailwind that pushed Iran's defense industry towards self-reliance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister says the people and leaders of Afghanistan must make difficult decisions for the future of their country. Mohammad Javad Zarif referred to the years-long failed presence of American troops in Afghanistan and its destructive consequences. He called on the Afghan leaders and political movements to return to the negotiating table and commit to political solutions. Iran's top diplomat also announced Tehran's readiness to assist the process of that dialogue solving the ongoing crises in Afghanistan. Zarif made the comments during a meeting between prominent Afghan figures and the Taliban's political delegation in Tehran. Political commentator Fouadi Zadi says reaching stability and peace in Afghanistan is not easy and that Iran is trying to alleviate the problems between the two sides by hosting the Afghan peace talks.
The hope that Iran has is that finally we may get to peace with U.S. Troops leaving Afghanistan, at least a good portion of the American troops leaving Afghanistan. Iran hopes to see peace. We are going to go through a period of instability, and Iran is worried about more bloodshed in Afghanistan. Having a peaceful Afghanistan is obviously good for Iran and other neighbors of Afghanistan. It's also good for people in Afghanistan. Achieving that goal of reaching a settlement in Afghanistan and achieving peace is not going to be easy. If it was easy, it would have been done a long time ago. Hosting the meeting today in Tehran between the different parties that are having difficulties in Afghanistan is a step by Iran to basically see if difficulties and problems can be resolved.
The Taliban have attacked the Afghan city of Qalayno in their first major assault on a provincial capital. Officials say fierce fighting is underway in the capital city of Badghis province. Militants have seized police headquarters and offices of the country's intelligence agency. Afghanistan's defense minister, Bismillah Mohammadi, said government forces are in a very sensitive situation, adding that the war is raging with the Taliban. Badghis governor Hisamuddin Shams says the militants have entered the city and all districts have fallen into their hands. The militants have increased their attacks on Afghan cities and villages since May and have already seized dozens of rural districts. Italy has eased curbs on arms exports to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, despite criticism that those weapons are being used in the war on Yemen. According to Italian government sources, restrictions implemented in 2019 to block arms and equipment sales to the two Arab regimes will be lifted. However, sources said the ban imposed in January to halt the sale of nearly 13,000 missiles will remain in place. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 with arms and logistics support from the U.S. and several Western countries. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. And the 16th round of peace talks on the Syria crisis has started in Kazakhstan's capital, Nur-Sultan. Diplomatic delegations from Iran, Russia, and Turkey came together for the two-day talks after the meeting was delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, is also attending the talks along with a delegation from the Syrian government and its opposing parties. The focus of this round of the negotiations is the situation on the ground in Syria, as well as confidence-building measures, including a prisoner swap. The last round of the talks were held in Russia's Sochi in February. The talks were initiated by Turkey, Iran, and Russia in 2017 in an effort to bring peace to the Arab country, which has been ravaged by foreign-backed terrorism since 2011. The political and economic crises are deepening in Lebanon amid political division on the formation of a new government after almost 11 months. Lebanon is short of being called a failed state, but who would actually gain from Lebanon's downfall? Sanctions placed by the U.S. and France have prevented any major investment from taking place in the country, which put their motive into question. Meanwhile, the Hezbollah chief has accused the U.S. of creating instability in the country.
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents, and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the demise of Lebanon. Diab has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come.
The issues surrounding Lebanon's crisis are truly staggering. The economic and financial crises are possibly on the top of the most severe issues in the country since the mid-19th century. GDP per capita has fallen by around 40% in dollar terms. Such a brutal contraction is usually associated with conflicts or wars, and it doesn't help when Saudi Arabia pulls all of its funds out of Lebanese banks.
Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
The World Health Organization sounds the alarm on the country's lack of resources in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic.
While we are progressing controlling the pandemic, it remains in a very dangerous phase. The only way out is to support countries in the equitable distribution of personal protective equipment, tests, treatments, and vaccines.
WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom said, countries that control the supply of instruments to fight the coronavirus are easing restrictions. This is while countries without access to sufficient supplies are facing waves of hospitalizations and death. Tedros also said the WHO's global appeal for funding for coronavirus equipment is still $17 billion short, almost half of its total needs. COVID-19 is spreading around the world with more than 180 million confirmed cases and around 4 million deaths across nearly 200 countries. Officials in the Australian state of New South Wales extend a coronavirus lockdown in Sydney amid a rise in cases related to the Delta variant of the virus.
The New South Wales government, based on the health advice, which is our key indicator, made the difficult decision to announce the extension of the lockdown and the existing restrictions in the regions for 1 week further until Friday midnight, the 16th of July.
The state prime minister said the reason for the extension is that the Delta variant is a game changer as it's more transmissible. The decision comes after the state reported 27 new cases. Sydney has been under lockdown since June 26. After a Delta variant outbreak, the city's total infections have now topped 350. Indonesia has reported a record number of daily coronavirus deaths with more than 1,000 fatalities in the past 24 hours. The country also recorded over 34,000 new cases of COVID-19. Indonesian officials say the country has witnessed a fourfold increase in its total caseload in the past month. They link the surge to the new highly contagious Delta variant. India also reported nearly 1,000 deaths in the same period with more than 43,000 new coronavirus cases. That brings the South Asian country's total caseload to over 30 million. South Korea has also recorded its highest daily COVID-19 caseload since December with 1,200 new cases. The spike has prompted South Korean officials to extend social distancing measures all amid the spread of the new virulent strain of coronavirus in their country. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. The next point I am going to make is about the soundness of the elections. I have previously mentioned, talked about, and now I'm also emphasizing that fortunately, during all these years, our elections have always been sound. Those who protest, yes, there may be some disruptions in some parts, but the elections in general have been sound with strong management. Clear evidence and strong support for this claim is that during these years, presidents with totally different orientations have been elected in the presidential elections of the Islamic Republic. Well, this shows that the elections have been sound. The elections have not been dependent on a particular political school of thought or a particular political orientation. No, they have been based on the law. Sometimes a president with a particular political orientation has been elected, and after him, another president with a totally different orientation has been elected. Therefore, our elections have been always sound. Some say the elections are not competitive, but no, thank God, they are competitive. Well, you watch the debates, and I have some points to make about the debates. I will talk about these after the elections. You watched how in the debates the honorable candidates showed that they are acting quite competitively. This means that there were disagreements between them, both intellectually and in their speech, and each one of them had his own followers. Of course, this is one of the indisputable facts about our elections. However, our enemies have always questioned the elections from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution and up until now. From the day when the referendum of the Islamic Republic of Iran was held with more than a 98% turnout until now, they have questioned all the elections. Well, one does not expect the enemies to admit that our elections are sound. It's interesting that there are some countries that are being managed based on tribalism in the middle of the 21st century. This means they are being ruled and run by a tribe, and there have been no elections. They have not even heard of elections. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Since 1941, Americans have annually celebrated Independence Day on the 4th of July, a celebration that goes back to the 18th century, when American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. The Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, endowed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it seems these laws did not apply to Native Americans as well as African Americans. This 4th of July, the United States is grappled with a global pandemic. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the coronavirus pandemic in terms of infections and fatalities. Also, the U.S. is experiencing an intense period of political and social unrest. On January 6th, a mob of then-President Donald Trump supporters stormed the Capitol while Congress was holding sessions to officially certify President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 race. The attack left 5 people dead, including a Capitol police officer. Trump's critics said his incendiary remarks during his speech on the same day encouraged his supporters to storm Congress. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group.
According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. Experts say the dramatic gap in police shootings and prison rates reflects biased policing, as well as the vast economic and educational inequalities that plague much of the country.
Because the United States has never, ever really come to grips with the racist foundations of the country, and it has never come to grips with the racist elements within the country that continue to this day.
This 4th of July, a new Yahoo News and YouGov poll showed that a majority of Americans believe everything about the United States is on the wane. 62% of Americans who responded to the survey said the U.S. is no longer the shining city on a hill. They feel the country is getting worse and are deeply divided over how to handle the coronavirus and protests sparked by the death of George Floyd. 49% of Americans said the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic was worse than expected. Yet America's gloomy outlook goes beyond the pandemic. 64% of Americans say race relations, the focus of mass protests since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer in late May, are also getting worse. Floyd's death sparked protests across the U.S. and globe that are a reminder of the oppression that people of color in the U.S. have always faced.
So, this whole idea of America being this shining city on the hill, that's mythology. And so what we should do is leave mythology to the Greeks. And we should try now to deal in reality. And the reality is that the United States sees itself as a unitary global hegemon, but what has now become a multipolar world. And Americans refuse to understand that reality. We are no longer the sole bully on the block. There are now other countries that are resisting America's sanctions regime, that can stand up to America's military might.
The once shining city on the hill was built upon the blood and sweat of Native American people and African slaves. 4th of July marks the dawn of a colonial system that came to existence by shedding the blood of millions of Native Americans and enslaving millions of Africans. The United States envoy to the U.S.-led anti-Daesh coalition has warned of a possible resurgence of the Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria due to worsening poverty and inequity there. But what is the root cause of the instability and poverty afflicting Baghdad and Damascus? 2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos resulted from the U.S. invasion eventually gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. 3 years after, the Takfiri group captured nearly one-third of Iraq's territory. However, Baghdad finally declared victory over the terrorists in December 2017. The victory was owed to the bravery of commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists. However, in a criminal and terrorist act, the U.S. killed these two figures in January 2020. That blatantly contradicts Washington's concern about the resurgence of Daesh. Following the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, anti-U.S. sentiments escalated in Iraq. U.S. bases in the country have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. While the U.S. claims it cares about Syrian civilians, it has imposed crippling economic sanctions on Syria that prevent the country from rebuilding after a decade of war.
It's really hard to be really clear about what's the motivation here, because it could just be stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity in U.S. foreign policy, pig-headedness. The CIA, when people say, why do you keep invading and destroying countries when it doesn't work, when it doesn't help you? And the answer that the CIA gives is, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's just that's the way we function. It's almost like it's an instinct to invade, to create chaos. So that's one possibility. Another one that's related to this is could just be sour grapes. It could be spoil sport, that the U.S. sees that these countries want to become independent, want to develop independently of the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple the government of President Bashar Assad. After failing to do so through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government implemented additional sanctions in Syria through a law known as the CSAR Act. The crippling sanctions under the CSAR Act specifically target energy and construction sectors to prevent Syria from rebuilding after a decade of war. The CSAR Act enabled Washington to sanction any person involved in reconstruction efforts in government-controlled parts of Syria. The correlation between U.S. economic sanctions and the crisis in Syria is clear. Syria's currency has plummeted and prices for basic goods have soared as a result of the sanctions. According to the UN, 60% of Syrians lack access to sufficient food. Besides the economic embargo, the U.S. has also occupied oil fields in Syria's northeast, depriving Damascus of a vital resource. Moreover, the UN has warned that U.S. sanctions have hampered humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria.
Yes, they do want a certain amount of instability and chaos wherever their own interests are threatened. So Syria, it was clearly the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-American force, anti-Israel force in the Middle East.
Washington alerts that Daesh terrorists might start regaining territory in Iraq and Syria as a result of poverty and instability there. That's why the U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there. Besides sanctions, U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh never would have formed.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'arib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes in residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarallah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarallah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'arib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They're pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces are closing in on Ma'arib, the last stronghold of pro-Hadi forces in northern Yemen. The loss of the strategic region would mean the defeat of the Saudi-backed regime. Yemeni forces had earlier liberated several strategic heights in the northwest of the province after intense fighting. Analysts believe control of the oil-rich region of Ma'arib would strengthen the bargaining position of Yemeni forces in peace talks. The fierce clashes come amid fresh attempts to bring an end to what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is desperate to find a face-saving way out of its disastrous bombing campaign in Yemen. It is believed that the Saudi regime has failed miserably in Yemen, as its foreign interventions have failed to produce desirable results for the kingdom.
Clearly, it shows that Saudi Arabia could not prevail through military measures. So now they are talking about, let's have a peace agreement. But they're asking for many things that they could not win on the battlefield. So whether they will gain it in peace talks, that's highly unlikely.
The new administration in Washington has pushed for fresh attempts to bring the war to an end. But Yemeni forces have dismissed the so-called peace initiatives presented by the U.S. to end the war in the country, saying such plans are not favorable since they fail to include the Yemeni nation's demands, including lifting the siege on the port city of Aden.
The UN is acting in favor of major powers and exhibits clear bias. The aggressor countries are committing the most heinous crimes against Yemeni children, and yet they were not included in the list. The UN decision is disconnected from realities and does not rely on independent accounts.
Any peace agreement must be based on ending the siege, the closing of the ports, and the distribution of food to the population of Yemen, who've been held hostage by Saudi Arabia and also by the U.S. through this whole process.
Ansarallah movement says no just solution to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been worked out yet. The Yemenis say the aggressors have to end all their attacks against Yemen, take out all their forces, end an all-out siege that they have been imposing on the Arab country, including the port city of Aden, and compensate the victims before entering any peace process.
Well, they certainly have no desirable result. They first announced that this would be a war over in a matter of weeks and then months, and it has dragged on for more than 6 years. So it's a complete disaster in the eyes of the entire region. It does show the weakness of this corrupt regime that is unable to carry on a war against a country far less technologically, doesn't have the means, doesn't have the military forces, and yet it has a mobilization of the people. And that is what is decisive again and again, as we're finding in every country.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies have been engaged in a devastating war in the country that began in March 2015. They were backed by the U.S. and other Western powers. The aggressors were trying to reinstall Yemen's former president Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, a staunch ally of Riyadh, to crush the Ansarallah movement. The Saudi war has failed to achieve its goals, but pushed Yemen to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Saudi officials claimed that the war would last only a few weeks.
The last German soldiers to withdraw from Afghanistan. Over the last couple of years, Germany had the second largest contingent of troops after the United States. The German defense minister says that after nearly 20 years of deployment, the last soldiers left Afghanistan. Annegret Kramp-Karren Bauer added that this is the end of a historic chapter of an intensive mission. 59
German soldiers died in Afghanistan. 35 of them had been killed in combat or as a result of militant attack, making it Germany's deadliest military mission since World War II. Looking back, the minister vowed to discuss where it went wrong and what Berlin has learned.
We've not only accomplished nothing, we have grievously damaged Afghan society over the last 20 years of bombing and so on and so forth. There was never a political coalition in Afghanistan to support the United States, even less so than in Vietnam, in my opinion.
Because of the security problems in Afghanistan and the increasing levels of violence, the German military kept the details of its withdrawal vague. Berlin sent its forces in the wake of the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001. Meanwhile, British media reports suggest the majority of British troops have quietly withdrawn from Afghanistan. Again, Britain withdrawing its forces, if confirmed, would have been shrouded in secrecy. According to the latest UN report, US-led forces, in particular Germany and Italy and the UK, are leaving Afghanistan while the country remains in bad shape. Violence is on the rise and Afghans are facing multiple crises, including rising poverty, which could increase from 50% to 70%. These all suggest that over two decades of foreign military presence has failed to bring peace to Afghanistan. In mid-April, US President Joe Biden and NATO announced they would pull out the roughly 10,000 foreign troops still in Afghanistan at the time by September 11, marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York that sparked the invasion of the country itself. The mission had been aimed at toppling the then-ruling Taliban government. 20 years later, Washington has been negotiating with the militant group itself on the best way to withdraw. During those 20 years, Afghans have witnessed a spiral of violence and terror.
It's obvious that this 20 years here hasn't benefited the Afghans in any way. Here we are with 2,500 troops left, more or less, who knows, you know, thousands of contractors, and several different things have come out in the newspaper in the last week. One, in spite of all this alleged training and so on and so forth, the only thing that is flyable in Afghanistan right now over the next few weeks are the Russian-made helicopters.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials speaking to CNN on condition of anonymity indicated that America itself may complete its withdrawal within days. One official says the Pentagon is considering keeping at least 650 troops in the country to safeguard the American embassy and Kabul airport. This comes as violence has sharply increased between Taliban militants and government forces since the U.S. missed a May withdrawal deadline agreed between the militants group and the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump. According to the Pentagon, the Taliban are now estimated to be in control of 81 districts out of the country's 419. There are fears of a looming civil war as the warring sides struggle to clinch a possible power-sharing peace deal during intra-Afghan negotiations.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wa al-Arab, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, there is a man who's been away from his wife for, let's say, 10, 12 years, okay?
Yes.
And there wasn't any kind of sexual intercourse, basically, so there was no touch, all right?
Yeah.
As a result, they didn't have any kind of intercourse or intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, does their marriage still hold?
Well, the marriage is not affected by the period of time a man stays away from her, from his wife, no matter how long it takes the husband to get back to his wife,
mm-hmm.
the marriage still holds and it remains
valid.
Valid, yes, of course. But when it comes to the Sharia point of view, with regard to a woman, with regard to a man staying away from his wife, of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that the obligatory precaution is that the husband should not avoid having sexual intercourse for more than 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes.
Especially if his wife is young. Okay, then there's a precaution, and that precaution is obligatory, and he should not avoid having sexual intercourse with such a wife. And if the wife is, let's say, disobedient, or it has been stipulated in the marriage contract that they should not have sexual intercourse, of course, there's no problem, you know. It is completely within the rights, with the wife's rights, right to have her husband once every four months.
Yes.
But if it has been stipulated or agreed mutually that they will not have sex during their entire life,
mm-hmm.
then sexual intercourse is not a necessary condition
mm-hmm.
for the validity of the marriage contract.
I see.
And Ayatollah Sistani says that the precaution is that this ruling applies to temporary wife, not to permanent wife, because in a permanent wife, in a permanent marriage, the wife is supposed to be available for sexual intercourse, and this is one of the rights which cannot be denied, which the husband cannot be denied, you know?
I see.
Ayatollah Sistani also says that the husband does not have the right to prolong his journey and to stay away. For example, he goes to, let's say, to a neighboring country, works there for 10 years, and his wife is struggling back in his hometown, and it is very much likely that the wife might end up falling into a sin, no matter what the sin is, but because of her husband is staying away from her.
Yes.
Then,
or maybe she can't afford the necessities of life,
very
the basic needs of life.
So it's not
what
permissible
happens?
For the husband to unnecessarily prolong his journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a valid excuse, a reason, for example, the borders are closed, maybe he has lost his passport, or maybe he is in a detention facility and he is not able to get back to his wife. These are valid justifications, and there's no objection to the
yes.
husband in this case. Now, there is one supposition. You know, the wife may not be able to wait for her husband, and she might commit a sin in the absence of her husband, you know, in the absence. If she cannot wait for 4 months, and it is, of course, feared that she might fall into a sin, and if she does not have sex with her husband, then the obligatory precaution is that they should have, sexual intercourse before the 4 months. The obligatory precaution is that the husband and wife should have sex before the 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 4 months is the maximum time period in which a man should have sexual intercourse with his wife.
Right.
But if she cannot wait, then it is necessary for the husband to have sexual intercourse with his wife before this time to make sure that his wife does not fall into a sin. And if this is not possible, then of course it is better for the husband to divorce his wife and set her free.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
you know, sometimes this happens, and in the meantime, as you also nicely put, the woman is somehow in a difficult situation, especially financially. Despite the fact that she tries very hard to communicate, there is no news coming back from her husband.
Yeah, right.
So how long can she wait to get married?
Yeah,
like, because the man is away and there is no news.
News, yes.
You don't know whether the man is dead or not, or is coming back or not. So can she get married
right.
in the meantime?
Well, she cannot get married as long as she is pretty sure that her husband has died, you know? And I think it will take time. Maybe it will take her 10 years, maybe it will take her 1 year, and it depends, you know, on the time and circumstance. And as long as she is not sure that her husband has died, she cannot take action for remarriage. You know,
but sometimes men leave their families for good,
yeah.
and they don't even let their family know that they wanted to separate.
Yes.
But since the man is gone, can she assume that the man, in fact, agreed to separate, all right, but not let her know?
That is not a license for the wife to get married to another, you know, because her husband has separated, but he may not have, you know, divorced her. And as long as the husband has not informed his wife, then the wife can presume
mm-hmm.
that she is still married to her husband, and she must consider herself as married, you know, as long as she is not informed that that her husband has divorced her according to Islamic Sharia, you know.
But sometimes men could do such a thing to punish their wives. For example, they had a fight, they didn't have a kind of happy marriage,
yep.
all right?
And
so the man leaves without saying goodbye.
So
what happens then?
Yeah, still she remains married, you know. Actual separation, which is acceptable according to Islam, happens when there is a valid divorce, when the husband carries out the divorce in the presence of two just witnesses, and when all other conditions, because there are certain conditions to be fulfilled for divorce in order to be valid.
Mm-hmm.
One of the conditions, very important conditions, is that there should be two witnesses. And then the divorce should take place at a time when the wife is not in her monthly period. You see, she should have purified from the first period, from the monthly period, and then in the state of cleanness,
mm-hmm.
purity from menstrual blood, it is permissible to perform to carry out